Welcome to Pouring Over Pages, a podcast of words and wine. I'm Alexa.
And I'm Maritza.
Let's get lit on literature. Yay!
This is so exciting.
It's been a minute, guys.
It's been a hot minute and a lot has happened.
Oh my God, we're in a different world.
We're in a different Britney world. Spears. Shit.
We recorded that a while ago. It's been months.
So much has happened. And in part, I think, like, just professionally, we've had so much going on and we rightfully have taken a lot of time off. Alexa's been traveling. I've been taking time off. Like, things that just allowed for us to, like, revamp and recharge and give ourselves a little bit of time. And we've also just been too busy at work.
Yeah, work has been insane.
It's been too many things, too many shows, too many exhibitions, too many...
Too much. Just too much in the art world, too.
Yeah, too many fires to put out.
Yeah.
And we're back. And it's worth saying, though, that we never stopped reading.
No.
Or drinking wine.
Or drinking wine, clearly. I mean...
That doesn't end.
Shit, I think in the past month I've read 2 books alone, so...
Yeah. No, you've been moving along. I'm glad you didn't take The Handmaid's Tale with you as your beach read.
Me too.
I feel like that would have been a really bad...
That would have been a bad mood killer.
Yeah, that would have been a bad mood. But... We are chatting today about a book that we loved that was then turned into a movie that we hated.
Yeah.
And there's just nothing better for a conversation than that. I think every other adaptation that we've reviewed, we've been quite fond of the movie. We really liked Crawdads. Mm-hmm. We really liked Red, White, and Royal Blue, Leave the World Behind. And I think this is the first one where we're just like, no, this didn't work.
No,
and
horrible.
The book and movie that we're referring to is The Idea of You by Robin Lee. The book is quite popular and it surged again on the bestseller list when it was announced that Anne Hathaway and Nicholas Galitzine were going to be cast for the Amazon Prime adaptation of the movie. And I was really excited about it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I'm going to read the book first. I didn't expect to like the book as much as I did because the plot, the kind of summary on the back flap of the book just sounds very generic. It doesn't really sound that fascinating mm-hmm. to me, but the author did such a good job of tackling really interesting issues about women and aging mm-hmm. and how your perception of yourself and your self-worth changes over time as you age. The differences between, you know, a woman dating a younger man versus a man dating a younger woman, all these different themes that were really, really interesting. And I think the author did such a phenomenal job. And we're excited to tackle those today. But the movie didn't really meet those expectations. No. And it didn't allow for there to be interesting conversation around these topics in the same way that the book did.
No, at all. It was night and day, unfortunately. The book was great, better than we expected. It was racy, it was sexy, it was, you know, thoughtful and complex, and you have all these different layers of different relationships and what they mean. And then the movie was just like, she's just a sad divorcee that's poor who has a hot young thing that likes her. It was just like cringy.
Yeah, the movie's not it. No. But for those of you who haven't read the book or watched the movie and you're tuning in anyway, I'll give you a very brief overview. And this is essentially a story about a woman named Solène Marchand. She is an LA gallerist. She's in the art world and she meets Hayes Campbell, who is this guy that's part of a boy band and they're extremely Ooh. Popular and they hit it off immediately. They're instantly attracted to one another and the book kind of follows the trials and tribulations of what that relationship looks like and of course the damning of her reputation through the public eye and all of these different things that become a part of what inevitably would happen if you're a relatively unknown woman dating a younger celebrity dude. So it's very, again, like Alexa said, it's like racy, it's funny, it's sexy, it's entertaining. I couldn't put it down. And what I just described is not how I would describe the movie. The
movie's boring.
Because the movie is boring and... She's not this powerhouse. Anyway, we'll get to
that.
Yeah,
we'll get to it.
But in the meantime, what are we drinking?
So we are drinking champagne Pommerie. Woo! I chose this wine because it has, obviously, champagne is in France. It's French. The main character, Solène, is of French descent, so I felt appropriate to go down that rabbit hole. But also, Madame Pommery has English influence in the Champagne House, so I thought it was a perfect marrying of the two characters, and we'll get into that later.
I love it, and it tastes fantastic.
Woo!
So, as you guys
great
know,
breakfast wine.
Is great, we're recording. Yes, we're recording.
It is. Oh, well, now it's
well,
later.
Now it's noon. It's 12:11. But we did crack the bottle open before noon.
Yes.
So I'm still going to stick to breakfast wine. But this has been such an interesting comparison. We both read the book a while ago. But I watched the movie like right when I was done with the book. You watched the movie last night.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of complaints via our WhatsApp. You were not happy. No. And I had told you, I was like, it's not that bad. Like, it's actually like it's fine. And then I realized like, wait, no, like that's not like I lied to her. Like that's not true. Like, because I had gotten over the fact that it's not as good as the book. Like I've had time to like accept yes, the choices yes. that I've made. But for you, it was like, wait, why am I watching
like a
this?
Fresh wound. I'm like, ah, why?
Yeah, it was not great. So I guess overall thoughts on the book, we agree. We loved the book. We enjoyed it. I think it was great. I think maybe an easy place to start is Solène and Hayes, the two main characters. Like, what did we think about their character development and the relationship timeline? And do we think it was successful? And I guess we can answer that for both the book and the movie.
The book I thought did a really great job of positioning them both, because clearly you have Hayes is the young, rich pop star who everyone just like falls head over heels over, and he has a certain power to him and a charisma and a maturity to him in the book, which is perfectly matched with her when she comes into the picture, because she's a powerhouse gallerist, successful, rich, cultured, just like a real woman. So when they're matched together, you don't really see him as like a doting little boy like you do in the movie.
Totally.
They're equally matched. If anything, like he might even have an upper hand because of his celebrity. So it just feels right in the book versus the movie.
I agree. And I think that the way that the author portrays her in the book is empowering, fun, mm-hmm. interesting. She is a divorced mom. She's a single mom. And the way that it's portrayed is really, I think, again, empowering. And I think that she is such a strong character and she's an inspiration. Yeah. I loved the way that the author like depicted the art world and
yes,
her within
it. They did a good job.
It was accurate, mm-hmm. you know, it was very much like, oh, you know, now I'm going to the Armory show and I'm
yes,
going to
freeze
and like all this stuff. And I was like, oh shit, like that's my life. And I really liked that it was portrayed in such an accurate way. And the art world is so fast and it has this, you know, reputation of being like so glamorous. So I thought it was interesting that that's how, like you said, the author positioned the two of them, is that she's also this powerhouse and she's very wealthy and she has this very successful gallery. And I thought that was great, because in the movie, she is not that. In the movie, she has this like little tiny gallery, like, and I'm not trying to like shit on little tiny galleries, but she's it's like almost like a little like arts center. Like it's nowhere close.
It's not like a fine art gallery.
No, and it's nowhere close to what she describes in the book. So I was like, wait, what? And she has this like adorable but like little house. And I was like, wait,
a little cottage.
And I was like, this girl in the book lived in this like glass house that was like gorgeous.
Overlooking
with, like,
views. And it just didn't make sense.
So I was like, oh, okay. So you're making her less successful. Got it. And then Hayes in the book is unrealistically emotionally intelligent
yes.
for being 20 or 21 years old, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I was like, this will never happen. I was like, a woman wrote this book.
Definitely fiction.
I was like, there is no 20-year-old guy on earth that would act like this. But because they were like evenly matched, mm-hmm. it made sense. And I was able to allow myself to enjoy even the relatively unrealistic
yeah.
elements of his character and personality. In the movie, he is not that. In the movie, he is a little bit more immature, this kind of like doting dork. I mean, yeah. I don't think older. It was cast well. And he was older. And I don't think it was cast well. I mean, this is the same guy, Nicholas Galitzine, who was the Prince Henry in Red, White, and Royal Blue. And he was perfect for that role. Yeah,
perfect.
But for this role, I'm just like, I'm supposed to believe that you're the hot rock star? Like,
it's true.
Like, no. Like, it didn't make sense to me. And I was really disappointed by the character development in the movie because they cut corners and they made him someone significantly less interesting. What makes the book appealing is that she managed to find a dude who was actually emotionally intelligent and that the relationship could work.
Yes.
In the movie, exactly. It could never work. And yet they end up together in the movie.
Yeah, it was just...
That pissed me off.
I didn't like that. It was a curveball that I didn't expect. And I'm like, no, this isn't what makes it. Because in the book, they're equally matched. You know, there's always the thing of when there's an older person in the relationship, like, oh, they're taking advantage of the younger person or whatnot. In the book, they were perfectly equal in every way. So you never had that weird, creepy ick about it.
Exactly. And speaking of weird, creepy ick, it is so different to read a story about the woman being the older person in the relationship. Because that ick is still there.
Yeah, yeah.
When you flip it.
Oh, for
like,
sure.
Like, I don't care how evenly matched a man and a woman are. If the man is older by 20 years, I get the ick.
It's disgusting.
Like, period. Like, that's just not...
No.
That's not going to change for me.
At all. Anthony Kiedis, I used to love Red Hot Chili Peppers, like, yeah. With all my heart and soul. And right now, he's like, what, in his 60s or something? He's dating a 20-year-old. A fucking 20-year-old.
Yeah, fucking disgusting.
I'm just
It just, you know, for those of you who haven't listened to us in a long time, you know, it's just proof again that men are disgusting. Yes. I can't get over that. But in the book, it's like it made sense, and it just goes to show that power dynamics within gender are always going to be there, and that they do define a relationship because. At no point do you feel like she's taking advantage. At no point do you feel like there is something gross because within those gender norms, that's just not a part of the conversation, mm-hmm. right? Like, listeners agree to disagree, but to me, it seemed perfectly reasonable.
Yeah.
I mean, in the way that it was depicted, and I really enjoyed it. And so the movie, again, disappointed me in that way because it was an unrealistic relationship depicted and they end up together. Whereas in the book, and big spoiler alert, the relationship was realistic and it was really more the outside forces that made the relationship struggle, but they don't end up together in the book.
No.
It's an extremely fucking disappointing ending, but it made sense.
It
and
did.
I was like, completely, okay, like I get it.
I get
you know?
It makes me sad, but
yeah.
it's real.
Exactly. And one of the things that I definitely think that we have to talk about is the difference in how they tackled her daughter in the book versus in the movie. So as we mentioned, Solène has a daughter. Her name is Isabel, Izzy. And in the book, she's 12 years old.
Yeah.
And she's a huge fan of this band. Like, think of Alexa, early 2000s, Backstreet Boys. Maritza, early 2000s, NSYNC,
exactly.
Right? Like, this is the same vibe. And so this is, like, a 12-year-old girl who's super into the band, super into Hayes Campbell.
She
and then
probably
finds
kisses
out,
his poster every
for
night.
Sure,
like we do.
For sure. Those J14, like, posters that would come in the magazine. And it's like, okay, that is uncomfortable, obviously. And she starts this relationship with him and keeps it from her daughter for quite a while. And it becomes a big issue throughout the book because she does eventually find out and she feels like her mom, you know, took something from her and feels betrayed and all of that. And it makes sense in the book. And I'm so terrible, but I found her so fucking annoying.
I couldn't stand the daughter. Like, let your mother be happy, goddammit.
Let your mother live her life. You have a whole life ahead of you.
She got left. For a younger woman who's now pregnant and your father is moving on quite nicely, just let her have this one thing.
Just let her fucking live her life. And so I was very annoyed with Izzy. I hated her as a character. And
yeah.
I'm not empathetic about that kind of stuff.
Me
like
neither.
I get it.
Me neither.
Like, I don't have kids, so I'm just like, shut the fuck up. But I was disappointed by that. But then in the fucking movie, and that was one of the most interesting things about the book, right? Like that whole dynamic. Sure. But then in the movie, they remove it immediately, like completely, because Isabel in the movie is not 12 years old. She's like an adult.
Yeah. She's and like so, 16, 17 already in, yeah, in high
like
school.
Maybe even like, old. Yeah. Like, right. Like she was like a mature, yeah, person. And so they go and they meet the band because they go to this concert that was like nostalgic, uh-huh, for her. And she was like, oh my God, August Moon, which is the name of the band. Like they're so seventh grade. And yeah, so that, yeah, whole, yeah, dynamic of the mom and the daughter having issues with one another because of the relationship, that gets completely eliminated, mm-hmm, in the movie. And I get it. A movie is 2 hours. You can't put, you know, what happens in a 300-page book, yeah, in a two-hour movie. I get that. And you have to cut corners. But we talked about this in Red, White, and Royal Blue. Like, what they cut made sense. The parents in that movie are not divorced.
Yeah.
There's no sister. It's fine. But they were able to keep the kind of raw essence of the story. Yeah. What they cut here was arguably one of the more interesting elements of the book and of the story. So I was very disappointed by that.
No, I was too. And then the way that they found, the way Izzy finds out in the book is very scandalous and racy. Yeah. Like mama's on a yacht,
yeah,
getting head from,
yeah,
Hayes. And yeah.
Not a fun way to find out.
No, and then in the movie, there's like a cute picture of them together. Like it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Yeah, and it just, again, I thought that that was something that should have been maybe a bigger part of the plot in, mm-hmm, the movie. But it's okay. If you're going to just make her older and you're going to change the dynamic up, that's fine. But then don't take away that kind of powerhouse element of Solène.
Yeah.
Because you can't, I feel like the whole movie was watered down, and it was always watered down on Solène's side.
Exactly. Yeah. Even, like, the bullying, I mean, they showed some of it from, like, the fans and the critics and the news people. They showed some bullying of headlines and stuff. But they missed the whole element, too, of Solène getting packages of shit to her house. Like, hate packages of,
right,
dildos and horrible shit and her photos ripped up. And, yeah, like, I think that should have been addressed, too, because that's such a big part when Isabel's like 13 or whatever, like the safety of this child and whatnot. And then for her to, I don't know, for a 16, 17, 18 year old that doesn't really give a fuck,
yeah,
to then feel bullied and embarrassed, it just didn't make sense to me. If they had more of these like violent elements, I guess, or scarier elements.
Yeah, I agree. And also, I think that that touched on, again, one of the really fascinating aspects of the kind of fandom that surrounds, mm-hmm, boy bands, yes, or celebrities, yes, and things like that. Like, now that I'm an adult, I'm probably not in these circles in the same way. But
no?
Like one really like funny, like weird random example of, like, obviously, like, I'm super into Formula One, right? And there's this one driver that, like, his girlfriend and him, like, they became public last year. And she's really cute. She's like a she's like a model. She's like a very cute girl. She's very funny. You can tell she has like a great personality. Yeah. And all the fangirls of this driver made her life hell when they first came out in public. And they like reported her Instagram page so many times that like it got shut down.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, there's something so inherently toxic within fangirl culture.
Yeah.
And it's not always, like, I also listen to podcasts specifically about Formula One that are by women, and the whole point is like, no, let's make room for women in the sport, right? But it's like there is something, even like I think back to like when I was like into NSYNC and boy bands and stuff, like there is something weirdly toxic, this, mm-hmm, like competition that isn't real,
yes,
but it drives the success of the band and it drives the fandom and it ultimately is just a result of capitalism.
Oh,
but I,
sure,
thought it was so fascinating how it was portrayed in the book, because yeah, she gets bullied and harassed, and it's technically by young girls.
Yeah, it's the creepiest thing.
It's so creepy and so weird, and she had every right to be terrified. And it's like, what is the end goal here? It's just to make someone feel like they're not worthy of something. That's really all it comes, mm-hmm, down to. And so I was saddened by it, but I really liked the way that it was characterized and described in the book, because I thought this is so relatable. Mm-hmm. Like, any girl that's been in any sort of, like, fandom culture is going to be like, yeah, that's totally recognizable to me. Well, it's and like terrifying.
When, yeah. It's like when I used to fight with my friends in, like, fifth grade. I'm like, well, you can't like Nick Carter because I like Nick Carter. You need to like Brian, or you need to like Howie, or whatever. It's
right.
Like, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't actually matter because none of you are ever going to meet them.
No, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't fucking matter. But it also, like, and now I'm going to go, like, really deep with it, but it also just proves the point that women from a very young age are taught to be pitted against one another, as opposed to being in community.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's like these things that aren't real become the source of the competition, because that's how you get conditioned into believing that your self-worth is 100% connected to your connection to a man.
Yep.
Or your connection to certain types of success. And so it's just really fascinating. And I thought that it was a really important part of the book. And that's not touched in the movie at all. No. The movie was really, like, I think, very insular. It was very much about the two of them and the family and how they tackled it. But it didn't take into account who I believe is the biggest character, which is the public sphere and how they affect the relationship, because that's ultimately what made it impossible for them to be together in the book.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't their age difference. It wasn't their you know, different statures in life, the kid. No, it was the fact that the public did not want them together and kept threatening them.
Exactly. And then it became like there was three people in the relationship in a way that was unbearable and impossible to essentially maintain. And so, again, I would have liked to have seen that in the movie, but my biggest issue with the movie is Solène being watered down as a character so very much. She is not the same character as the book.
No.
Period. Like, I will absolutely die on that hill. Do you think that you would have enjoyed the movie if you hadn't read the book?
I wouldn't have been as bitchy towards it, probably, but I just found the movie to be boring.
Yeah.
Like, it was just slow. He wasn't engaging. She was sad. Like, I found myself looking at my phone a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I disliked it more because I read the book.
Yeah.
But I would never sit here and tell you that I would have thoroughly enjoyed it had I not read the book. I think the movie falls flat. It's not going to be a movie that I'm going to want to rewatch. Mm-mm. It's not going to be a movie that gives me a reason to feel intellectually stimulated.
No, at all.
At all. And it's also not like a fun or comfort watch. Like, I rewatch Red, White, and Royal Blue like at least every 3 months. Like, I'm obsessed with that movie. But because it's like, it's smart. It's just, it's done so fucking well. So I had high hopes for the idea of you, because I was like, oh, it's also Amazon Prime.
I know.
Like, they've dealt with like racy storylines before. I was initially really into the cast, actually. I was like, oh, Anne Hathaway and Nicholas Galantine. Like, that's actually like really interesting. Like, that sounds fun. Not fun.
No. But Amazon also fucked up Daisy Jones and the Six.
You're right. I totally forgot.
So they're
about
kind
that.
Of like hit or miss, it feels like.
They're,
you know,
very hit or miss. I think maybe it has to do more with how involved is the author in the production of the movie, and how much freedom are you giving Amazon Prime?
Yeah, because it seems like when they have more freedom, like with Daisy Jones, it just
goes off.
They just go to Greece instead of here and there, and it's just, and there's no drugs and sex, and
that was
somehow
fucking wild.
What addiction.
The only good thing to come out of Daisy Jones, honestly, was the music. I actually really liked the music in that show, but apart from that, I was like, no. I do think it was cast well, though. I liked her.
I think they looked good.
They looked
good.
She
was good. I just,
like, Daisy, like, that's exactly what I would
imagine. Yeah, Daisy for sure.
Like. But this movie just, it didn't make sense to me. I mean, okay, let me put it this way. When I was reading the book, I already knew who was cast in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of imagining them as I read the book, but more so her, like more so Anne Hathaway.
I could see her as the book character.
100%.
With the confidence, put together.
Yeah, 100%. Like. But I couldn't really see him in that same way.
No.
And the daughter situation was also strange to me. So it's a miss.
Yeah.
Read the book. The book is great, and you're not going to want to put it down, and it's so interesting, and it really gives you this idea of like being inside of the relationship.
Yeah.
It's fun and it's suspenseful, and every chapter ends and you're like, wait, 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 what? And you want to keep reading. It's just, it's written well. It's enjoyable. The movie, no.
Just take it off your watch list. Now.
Yeah.
Remove it now.
Just watch Red, White, and Royal Blue instead. Again.
I mean, watch that. Shit. I was watching Love Island instead of this. I'm like, no, never mind. Let me go back to Love Island. Which I hate. I hate that show, but it's kind of addicting, but I fucking hate it.
Yeah. I've never seen it.
Don't. I only watched it this season because Ariana from Vanderpump was on it.
Oh.
She was hosting it.
Oh.
So I'm like, oh, let me watch it. No, it's the worst show I have ever seen in my life.
And that's like, isn't there like there's an American version?
That's, yeah.
And there's a
British
version.
Yeah. And it's like a game show wrapped in a dating show, wrapped in a Survivor kind of thing.
What?
It doesn't make any sense.
I just described everything that I hate.
I hate it. But I just need to know how it ends now. So.
Yeah.
And I've realized through watching that show that I hate the sound of kissing.
Yeah, that's disgusting. It's like,
it's so bad. It's so bad. All they do is make out with each other. It's like a weird orgy. I don't know. It's weird. Let's get back to this.
I will not be watching that. I would rather rewatch the idea of you
yeah.
than to watch that. Actually, that sounds like my worst fucking nightmare. I hate that.
Oh my God.
Okay, let's talk about the big shebang, the endings.
Woo, the endings.
The endings are really different. Stunningly different. As we've already hinted at or said, the movie, they end up together, right?
Yeah.
Even though the story's kind of unrealistic and you're kind of bored and whatever, they end up together and you're like, oh, that's nice, I guess.
Yeah.
Happily ever after.
They're like, oh my God, in 5 years, when Izzy's older, we can make this work. Wait for me. Yes, of course. And then...
And he shows up 5 years later at her shitty little gallery and is like, hey. And she like turns around and she starts crying.
Yeah.
But she has so much Botox that like her forehead doesn't move.
It's
really, I mean, it's quite a scene. I will say that. It's worth maybe just watching that scene because it's hilarious, because the way that they show that he's aged is he has like terrible facial hair.
Yes.
Like he's got like a little mustache. And I'm like, this isn't it. You know, this isn't how you want to portray someone having matured. But so that ending, like, it was out of context, like, it was sweet, unrealistic again, that, like, you know, he waited 5 years and all this shit, right?
That guy is never gonna wait 5 years. That guy is gonna fuck five chicks in the next hour. Like, he's not waiting 5 years for
no,
her. I'm sorry.
Absolutely not. Not in the world that he was, like, living
no.
in. And
no, so, sex, so, drugs, rock and roll, no.
Yeah, so that to me was very, like, okay, sure. I would have believed that more in the book, because in the book it was very clear that he was very committed to her and that he was in a serious relationship with her and that she felt the same way. If anything, she's the one that was really resistant throughout the book. She's the one that makes it a lot more difficult for them to have the relationship. And so when the book ends and it essentially makes it very clear that they are not ending up together, and I was like, what the fuck. I was very upset. I'm not going to lie, because I was like,
no, I was
wanted more
too.
Than this. But it ends with a quote that makes me sad. It says, these little messages that would paralyze me. And then one day they stopped long, long before I had stopped loving him.
I know.
So they just stop communicating because she tells him, like, we can't do this. And then eventually he listens, because he does try for a while. And you find out there that it was long, long before she had stopped loving him. And so you're just like, you're so disappointed. This is the last line in the book. And you're like, what the fuck?
It like rips your heart out of your chest.
I was so disappointed, because like, I'm like, you're rooting for her, because you're like, this is a woman who's like worked really hard. She has this amazing career. She has a family, an unconventional family at that point, right? She's a single mom. But then you have this like wonderful relationship that actually feels really beautiful and wonderful and interesting. And then that just all goes away because of, again, that third character, which is like the public, the scrutiny.
And the 13-year-old little asshole.
Yeah, and it's so heartbreaking. And I was so, so sad that that's how it ended. But I was like, the story is not any less interesting or any less important just because they don't end up together.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a great commentary on this false idea of it has to be a happy ending to be worthy of your time. That is just so not true.
Yeah.
And there are so many like Disney movies that like would have been better off if the characters didn't end up together, you know, but we're conditioned to mm-hmm. believe that a story is only worth telling if it ends in a way that we approve of and that we're happy with. And that's just not true.
No, at all. And that was the case here. Cause yeah, the book, yeah, was pissed. I'm like, she deserves this. Mm-hmm. What the fuck? Why can't she just follow her heart? But it was realistic and it hit home. And it had an impact. It made me feel something. Books should make you feel something.
Exactly.
Like, I don't want to finish a book and be like, oh, okay.
That right. was nice. Well, I guess that was, well, was enjoyable. Okay. I like to have an earth-shattering, emotionally unstable book hangover. Like, I love to feel fucking horrible when I finish a book. Like, that's how I know that I gave it my all.
Yes.
You know? I want to feel like shit. I want the book to ruin my life.
I want to keep thinking about it days and weeks after.
And just like everything I see will remind me of the book. Like, that's how I know that I made the right choice. That happened to me recently. I just finished, for those of you who, we will never read this book on this podcast, I can guarantee you that. It's called A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. And it is one of the best books I've ever read. And I haven't been able to start my next book because I can't.
You're still processing. It's still, you still think about it. You still
yes,
can't get over
800 it. 800 pages of me being really committed to this story. And then it stops and you're like, what? You know? And like, oh, I don't feel good. So this book is not at that level. But it will make you feel like you invested something good. Like
yeah.
you did the work to get through the book and it was worth it because it was entertaining and it was interesting and it was self-reflective and it was fun. But you're like, shit, it came to an end and this is how it did it. And you're going to be a little disappointed, but not in a bad way.
No, you're not going to say, fuck this book and throw it away like I wanted to throw my remote at the movie.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So in short, read the book.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Don't watch the movie.
Plain and simple.
And then let us know your thoughts. Have you read the book? Have you watched the movie? Did you watch the movie but not read the book? Have you read the book but you don't want to watch the movie? Tell us.
We'd love to know.
We'd love to know. We're keen. So slide into the DMs.
Yes.
And in the meantime, cheers.
Cheers. Yes. With a great book, we have to pair a great wine. I mean, when I was looking for a wine, I was getting different ideas, thinking about, you know, the English side of Haze, the French side of Solène. I'm like, where do I go? What do I do? But luckily, I came up with Champagne Pommery, and it worked out perfectly, I think. It's a champagne house located in Reims. The house was founded as Pommery and Greno in 1858. Alexander Louis Pommery and Narcisse Greno, with the primary business of being wool trading, which is kind of weird and different.
That's so random.
Random. I feel like back then people just did random shit, like all the time. Like,
clearly.
Who even wool trades anymore?
Whatever paid the bills.
Whatever paid the bills back in the day. And then luckily it all changed when, unfortunately, Alexander passed away 6 months after purchasing the estate. But his savvy widow, Madame Louise Pommery, took the reins and guided the firm to ditch wool and became dedicated to champagne production.
It's always the women.
Women always have the
it's
best ideas.
It's always the women.
Women need to rule the world.
Yeah, I agree. Well,
let's get there.
We're so close.
We're so close. We'll get there. So I see a lot of Solène and Madame Pommery. They're both French and they take charge. She's also a huge art lover. She even had large sculptures engraved on the cellar walls. So there's more parallels to Céline here with the art world, the French world. So I just felt that it was a really great fit for her character. And then it was also, Pommery was the first house to commercialize a Brut champagne in 1874. In the UK, which is kind of like the link to Haze here, Madame Pommery decided that champagne needed to change. So back then, champagne was seen as kind of like a sweet dessert wine. And it's hard to imagine now because what we drink is so like brut and fresh and like dry. But back then they would drink it really sweet. So she was the innovator in removing the sweetness, the dosage from it to make it dry and crisp to be enjoyed, whatever. Not just after a meal for dessert, but before a meal, during a meal, without a meal.
That is anytime. So interesting.
Right? It's like the foresight and the trendiness to come up with that.
Women are so smart.
They really are. And this marked the birth of the Brut category, which most of us know and love. I mean, it accounts for 85% of all champagne consumed around the world. So when people think of champagne, that's what they think of. And it's all because of her.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I've ever had sweet champagne.
I've had like demi-sec, which is pretty sweet in compared to what we... And it's... Yeah.
That's so interesting. This one woman was like, hold on a second, there's a better way to do this. And now almost every single person drinks champagne in this way.
Yeah.
That is fascinating. Innovating. That is amazing. And how smart, because this stuff tastes fucking great.
It's amazing. And she's just like so smart. And, you know, today they keep innovating with help from England. So this is another part that I felt that there was like lots of cool parallels, but like something I didn't know I had to dig for. So obviously Haze is British, as we've spoken about in Red, White, and Royal Blue. English sparkling is now turning into a thing because of climate change. So even though champagne, obviously they're the top dogs, they think that they're the best in the world. I mean, they kind of are, I get it. But they have the foresight to now work in England and figure out what they could do with sparkling in England. So now they've created an English sparkling wine, the first English sparkling to come from a champagne house.
Wow.
So they decided that it's, you know, with climate change and everything, to capitalize on that investment. They've also decided to make wine in England because of her proud Anglo-French heritage. She was educated in England and hired an Englishman as the company's first sales director. So there's lots of ties between the two. And I'm sure... Like I said, climate change. Like at one point, champagne might not be making the same kind of champagne that they always do.
Right.
So they need to go more north. They need to go to these other regions that can produce the same amount of like crisp, sparkling, wonderful bubbles. So I think it's really smart of them to go dive over there and see what's up. I mean, I was actually trying to get that bottle, but they don't have it here.
So. Yeah. But it goes to show the culture within this company as remaining, you know, innovative, that they essentially invented Brut, right? And now they're moving in the direction of like, we know climate change is coming, we know that things are changing, and we're gonna move in that direction too.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And recognizing that there's more to sparkling wine than just champagne, that they can make a successful English brand, I'm sure it'll be fantastic.
For sure. I mean, we've had sparkling English, yeah.
And it was great.
And it was fantastic.
It's just hard right now to get it over here. There's only so many importers that import it here because it's a relatively new region. So, I mean, I'm sure with time, there'll be a lot more producers in America that we could try.
Yeah, I'm sure that will change.
And our favorite part.
The tasting.
Well, I've had this in my glass for a while, so the bubbles are kind of gone, but yeah. It did have fine, like, persistent bubbles.
Tiny little...
Yeah.
Little bubbles.
Tiny cute things. It's like a pale yellow, I want to say, maybe with, like, slight flecks of green.
A little bit of green, slightly. If you look at, like, the edges of it.
Yeah. Notes of apple.
Yeah, like green apple, lemongrass. Mm-hmm. It's very tart.
Tart, yes, very tart.
Citrus.
Yeah, citrus. The tartness goes to the palate.
Yeah.
Delicious. Earlier, I was getting some brioche on it. Now I'm not getting so much. I think it's
like
just
the sweetness.
Like bready. The breadiness, the yeastiness. Mm-hmm. But right now, I'm not getting as much, I think, because I've had it in my glass for a while.
Yeah, I think for me, I'm mainly getting that like very tart, fruity, citrusy.
Yeah, citrusy for sure.
Which is delicious.
Mm-hmm. No, it's good. It's a delicious one. This is their non-vintage Brut. I got it at 305 Wine. Shout out to them. We love them. I did my WSET level 2 with them, and they were great. I've taken many classes with them. And they just moved to, it's like US 1 and 87th, 80-something Avenue. Like maybe 81st or something. Mm-hmm. But they're great, and you could find it at their shop. I'm, like, looking right now to see the price.
Absolutely worth it.
So worth it. I mean, online I see it for, like, $55. I think there might have been, like, $60 or something. Mm-hmm. But I always like shopping local. And, no, it's a great It's a great champagne. It's a great champagne house. It's perfect as an aperitif or like with seafood, oysters, you know, fish, enjoying it. I mean, I always love Bubbles. I can't say no to Bubbles.
Yeah, I can't say no to Bubbles either. I feel like they do just kind of go with everything. And what I like about this one is that I feel like I can have it like at any time of the year. Like it is like I could have it outside in the sun, like poolside, but it's also like I can have it like in the winter at dinner. Like it doesn't have anything about it that makes it feel seasonal, which I think sometimes people do think about that with wine.
Yeah, like that's true.
I should only have like rosé in the summer, or I should only have like, you know, red wine in the winter. Yeah. It's like, no, I mean, granted, for us, seasons aren't real.
we don't know what seasons are
in Miami, but this just feels like such a great all-around champagne. And my metric of success is if I take this to someone's house, will they like it? And I'm going to say absolutely.
I'd say yes. Would the twins like it?
Would the twins like, shout out to the twins. Yay! They know who they are.
You know who you are.
It's funny because I had dinner with the twins the other night and I brought a bottle of Perrier Jouet.
Ah, yeah.
And we had that before dinner. And I was like, this is the life that like we deserve. Like we all just deserve to have champagne before dinner all the time.
Whatever we want.
All the time, whatever we want. I don't care. This is the life that I deserve.
No, I strongly believe that you shouldn't save bottles for just special occasions.
So I've learned that. It took me a while to learn that. That bottle, I've actually had it for a while. It was just sitting there and I was like, why is it just sitting there? Yeah. Like, what is the point of me having this bottle? And like, listen, prices are relative. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that that's not an expensive bottle for some people.
Yeah.
But in reality, like, I can go and I can pick one up at any time. Exactly. And so it's like, is it really that special? Like, I can always just go and buy another one. So, like, let's just go and, like, let's enjoy it and, like, celebrate it and drink it and not make it so that wine has to be this thing that is only ever reserved for a special occasion. That is just not true.
No.
It took me a really long time to learn that.
No,
a really
long time.
And
then once you do it, you're like, yes. And you find the joy in just those moments. Like whether it's Wednesday at dinner after, you know, a hard day, or, you know, celebrating with your friends over the weekend. Like
totally. It makes me think of COVID too, because speaking about 305 wines, you sent me a bottle during COVID when we couldn't see each other. And I don't know his name.
Guillermo.
Guillermo showed up at my door, knocked on my door with a bottle of orange wine that I loved that you sent to me. And I was like, this is the beauty of like, not only shopping local, but like acknowledging, like obviously there was nothing special going on. We were stuck in our houses. We all felt like shit. We were scared and terrified and I couldn't see you. And I was like miserable. And like, you sent me this bottle of wine and it became like such a... like such an important moment in my COVID
moments.
Time,
yes.
You know, like you make your moments with it. So it's just like, yeah, if you take anything from this episode, like if you have a nice bottle of wine at home, drink it with your friends, drink it with your family. It's not worth having something just sit there for the sake of it sitting there. Every day is a special occasion if you make it one.
Yes. Big cheers to that.
Big fucking cheers to that.
Well, I hope you all like this episode. I know it's been a minute. We're thinking, we're tinkering about our next book. If you have any suggestions, DM us. If you liked us, rate this podcast episode with all the stars, all the likes, all the follows. Follow us at Pouring Over Pages Podcast on Instagram. You could go on our Etsy shop, find merch, sign up for the newsletter. I mean, we have a flow link in the Instagram page. Just click all the links. See what
anything
we're up
you
to.
Need is up there.
Anything you need is up there. And until next time, cheers!